Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome everybody to Nightlight. So very, very glad you could join us tonight. We have Gary Wayne back with us again, and he's doing part two of our seven-part series. So buckle up. It's going to be a very exciting time. This show tonight is a special one, but let me give you a little bit of background first. As was graphically described in the first Genesis 6 conspiracy book, there are giants among us, passing largely unnoticed, intent on carrying out a secret plan to enslave humanity. They may not look like giants today, but their bloodlines and DNA extend all the way back to the Nephilim, the offspring of the angels who mated with human women, described in Genesis 6 when giants were roaming the land. Now in his new work, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2, he goes in depth with new information and explanations for each premise laid out in the first book. By adding this fact-filled book to your understanding, you'll be able to clearly understand and articulate how we are living in the end of time. This book was written to help answer the lingering questions many Christians have and to provide scripturally researched answers and data points for these questions. The Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2 explores the scriptures accounting of prehistory, history, and its important prophetic connections, and explains in layman's terms how it all fits together in deciphering the end of time. I have been reading through section by section, and I have to tell you, if you have any questions, I'm sure they're answered in this book, because I have never read anything quite this detailed. Though I'm not a biblical historian, I am learning so much from reading this book that it's mind-boggling to my friends who now think the only thing that I can talk about are giants and Genesis. So hopefully at the end of all seven of these, I can pull it all together and really bore them to pieces. So that said, welcome to Nightlight again, Gary. I'm so glad you're back with us.
Well, thank you for asking me to be back on your show and to do this series, and thank you so much for the terrific introduction, and glad that you're enjoying the journey in book two. It's as much as you did with book one, but hopefully in a different way, because I do think it is. Book one is really unique, and there's really nothing out there that's like it. Maybe pieces of it, but not like the whole story that's provided in Genesis 6 part one. And then this book is unique as well, and there's nothing out there like it. And it dovetails in with book one quite well, and overlaps a little bit here and there where it's necessary to tell a story from inside the Bible instead of from outside, connecting into the Bible, doing the reverse and providing so much more information and context for people. So, yeah, I think it's probably one of the most unique books that's out there. I think you could look at it as book two would be like Genesis 6 Conspiracy Book 1 on steroids. And if people are familiar with Dr. Heiser's work, then this is Dr. Heiser on steroids.
Well, you know, I'm learning so much more about the hierarchy that goes on and the 70 nations and assembly of gods. I mean, I don't recall that in the Bible, but I easily could have zoomed on by it. But it blew my mind, the hierarchies that are involved here. And you know, what is the purpose of all the hierarchies?
Yeah, it's so important to understand not only what's written in the Bible, but how this whole world works. And so, yeah, there is references in the Bible to, you know, the assembly of the nations. And that's, you know, in Psalms 82, where it has the council of the gods. And they rule over 70 nations, as Deuteronomy 32 talks about. And one of the things about the Bible is it adds more information all the way through on topics. And it's not done in a way that, you know, you can just sort of go out and quickly and assemble the information. But when you're able to reach out and pull pieces in and you understand the narrative, the pieces just start to fit together. And that's one of the keys, is to try and make the pieces fit, but don't force them to fit, and don't leave out inconvenient pieces, because you'll have gaping holes in the picture. So, yeah, so this is in there. And, you know, and it's really crazy when we look at these 70 nations that's written in Deuteronomy 32. And it's talking about it doesn't give you a number there, but where it gives you is the sons of Adam that ruled before the flood, and inferring there that Adam had at least 70 sons or descendants that were listed as patriarchs, probably akin to Noah after the flood, because the Bible works in those kind of patterns, and that it's the same number of nations that are going to be assembled through the descendants of Noah after the flood as are listed in Genesis 10 and then in First Chronicles, and then they're numbered very mysteriously in the passages, translated differently in a lot of the different translations that are out there. But in the KJV it says the sons of Israel, and the sons of Israel that were born to Israel, or Jacob as he had his name changed to, is listed in Exodus 1:5, where he had 70 sons while sojourning in the desert and within the Egyptian Empire. So you have this constant of these 70 nations, and of course the aspect of connecting Israel in, and I do talk about this at length in the section, so I don't want to get ahead of myself, but it's more not that Israel was created before the flood. It's not that Israel was there at the time of Genesis 10. They actually come out of the descendants of Shem and through the Abraham branch, but it's more as it's connected into Israel as a prophecy that's in there as well, and it's something that I call a dual prophecy. And it also has other meanings that really, when you dig into it, starts to make it fit all together. But yeah, that assembly is in there, and it's akin to what's written in other cultures around the world. So people might know of the Council of the Gods at Mount Olympus. Well, it's the same council. People have heard of the Council at Nippur, which is understood, and I talk about in Book 1, as Mount Hermon. And yeah, they have two assemblies there, and it's the same assembly that's being talked about in terms of Psalms 82 that is opposing the congregation that's talked about in Isaiah 14, another dual prophecy, and then his assembly as it comes down through other passages throughout the Bible. But you have these two assembly of the gods. And in that, you have, to get back to your question, is you have all of these angels that are led by Satan on the one side and God on the other side. And so depending on what belief system you come from, it's either a perpetual battle that never ends, or there is an ending, as the monotheist side would have, and what Christians and other monotheists believe. So it really is important to understand this kind of concept, that both polytheism and monotheism talk and confirm that there are these assemblies, and that they play a huge part within our world and our history and today and what's going forward. And, you know, it will until all of these things sort of play out. So it's important to understand this. And, you know, Section 2 is a lot like Section 1, where I'm going to provide essential information to understanding the Bible and then how that sort of will connect into other accounts around the world, and that it is how we have to come to grips with that as to what our belief system is going to be based upon, and bring it in it sort of back to the Bible. And later on in Section 2, I'll get in, you know, I get into the specific council as it's related to us in the Ugaritic text, which is original Semitic, which Hebrew comes out of. So a lot of the words are the base words for what we get into Hebrew, which is very important to see this parallel account from a polytheist lens talking about exactly the same things. And that's the council at Mount Saphon, that is Mount Hermon is named in the Bible. But yet in the Bible, Mount Hermon has Sion, Sirion, and Shinir as different names. And we may get into it tonight later on, but Mount Hermon had its name changed for a reason, and it's within the meaning of that word. So that's the Baalim Council that they're talking about. So from a Christian perspective, this is the Baalim and Baal leading that council of gods after the flood as an offspring god, and El, his father, leading that council before the flood. And biblically, that is essential information for us to better understand what the Bible is talking about when it's talking about post-diluvian giants and the Rephaim that we talked about in show one, and about the Baalim and all of these different words related to Baal throughout the Old Testament.
It's fascinating to me that you know, you have going on here also the as above, so below. So Satan did create a very similar hierarchy and government, so to speak, as God had in heaven.
He did, and it's that term. And so what they're talking about in that sort of reverse, and as from a Christian perspective, I would look at it as a counterfeit with my biases, when they're talking about, uh-huh, you know, as above, so below, or vice versa, is they're talking about below as being in Sheol or Hades or Argatha, the other world, Nibiru, you know, just many, many names around the world is where the gods rule from this pantheon, and is in the earth in likely another dimension. And so it is talking similarly, but with their temporary authority over this earth, and where God's assembly is in heaven, in another dimension, not necessarily, connected or in the same space as, let's say, outside the firmament, but perhaps there. Certainly we have stars that are shown and is an allegory for the multitudes of the angels, both loyal and disloyal. And also you have the seven wandering stars in the Bible that reflect the seven major gods in the pantheons around the world. And that number seven is a constant. So it's going to include a lot of the luminaries within the firmament, like the sun and the moon and Venus and Saturn and Jupiter and Mars and Venus as examples. And so it's just so important to understand that a lot of the terminology will be very, very similar, but from a slightly different perspective. And that's just huge to understand. And that these angels have been around since before creation. And, you know, I introduced Section 2 with a passage that I find is absolutely stunning as it goes on a little bit later, but it's about, it's in Psalms 104, and it's got later on in the passage about the renewal of the earth when God sends the Spirit. And this is another accounting of creation that works well with Genesis 1, but it's also talking about the angels in this creation, and also this renewal that happens that seems to be what happens after Genesis 1-2 when the Holy Spirit is hovering over the waters. And so in Psalms 104:4, it's talking about the God who makes the angels spirits, because angels, as we talked about last show, are spirit beings and take a physical presence, a physical form in the oikotarion that they create, a dwelling place for the spirit in the physical world to interact physically. And also it says there that his ministers are flaming fire. And typically that's understood as watchers, in terms of specifically as a flaming fire might be representative of the seraphim, which are the minister angels that work before the altar in the coals, in the flames of the altar before the throne, and act as ministers, just as Isaiah in Isaiah 6 has his sins taken away through one of the seraphim taking a stone and putting it to Isaiah's lips. And it also could be referred to as the cherubim, who have flaming swords as well. So we're talking about angels in two different aspects, of spirits and then ministers as a flaming fire. And that this creation was made before the foundations of the earth were laid, so some from before creation. So when you see in Job 38:4-7, where it's talking about these sons of God, they were celebrating with the morning stars when the foundations were set down. So that's kind of the key. As you start to link, you look for the similarities in the words and or the allegories, and define those allegories from within the Bible, as in stars, as we talked about in the last show. There's passages where you have a host of heaven and stars and sons of God and angels are used interchangeably throughout the Old Testament, and in many passages supportive of each other. So when you talk about this order of the angels, and they have all different names and ranks and positions in this hierarchy, that's the word that when you see the host of heaven, that the Old Testament also says for the Israelites not to worship, because a representative of that starry group on in the physical world as gods, not to worship the stars. It's not necessarily physically the stars, but the allegorical stars are as in the fallen angels, or as the Nephilim, as I call them in this book. And Nephilim, if for people who aren't sure where that word might come from, it's the root Hebrew word for Nephilim, as the sort of offspring of the giants. And you don't get that word Nephilim, as fallen ones are described in the understanding of rebellious angels in the Bible, but you get the word Nephal in its singular form that's used, just as when Satan falls from heaven in Isaiah 14, that word fall is a Nephal. And the Nephilim would be the fallen ones as the male plural, just as the Shemaim are the heavenly ones. And heaven is Shema, singular, never used, just Shemaim in the plural in the Old Testament. So the Nephilim, the fallen ones, are the Nephilim of the Shemaim. And you start to look at those terms as they come together, and everything sort of starts to make some sense for people. And so that word host is the Hebrew word sabach, as you were mentioning about this order that's in place. And that's a word, you know, it's spelt with a T and not just an S. It's like other words that's used in Hebrew, or T and an S will have, as it's transliterated into English, a S sound. So it's Saba, and it means an army of angels, and inferring rank and order. And so this section will get into that rank and order, both loyal to God and opposing God, and the locations of those assemblies.
In other words, I mean, the earth became just the mirror of heaven.
Originally, and then the mirror of the fallen ones after.
Yeah.
And so the mirror in the occult allegory is a portal. it's like the mirror on the wall where you have this demon spirit that's talking back from it, or mirrors are understood as into the other dimension or connection into it. So the application of the mirror, again, will reflect the belief system.
Yeah. No, I, you know, just in case you write another book, a chart would help. Just
a chart
showing, on the hierarchies and how they, because they go down to the principalities and everything else, and just having some sort of an idea as to levels and natures. And, you know, when...
Yeah, well,
I actually
provide that in this section. It comes right at the end of the hierarchy of the angels after... So you're probably not quite there yet, but we can talk about that. We can talk about that if you want. We can do it right now if you like. We can talk about the different orders and the different names, and then
I think the thing that prior to knowing you and your book and everything, my concept of angel was an angel of God, and the angels of God were just messengers. They couldn't, do anything but deliver a message. And that's what the angels were. And now suddenly I am seeing thousands of different levels of angels with different powers and different purposes and stuff. And it did blow my mind slightly. It never occurred to me that they'd have different jobs and different levels and different powers.
Yeah, so how much we lose in the translation out of the original languages, both in the Hebrew and in the Greek, that it would make a lot larger book to put more of the meanings of the words in, but it would be very, very helpful. So, yeah, there's more orders than people generally sort of understand. And so when we talk about hierarchy, that has a word that's a word that's rooted in this assembly of the gods, and that hierarchy is a Greek word describing this assembly of the gods. So it's important to sort of understand that if there's a hierarchy, then that there is a there's rank and there's orders, and that this is a word that kind of helps us really understand things in this world. So, hierarchy derives, just so that people have a better understanding of what I'm talking about, is Greek hierarchia or hierarchies, and it means ruler of sacred matters, and a collective body of angels grouped in three divisions and nine orders. And that comes from the Greek word hieros, meaning sacred, and archaon, meaning to rule, as in archon or archon, as it comes out of Hebrew, that's defined as first rank, chief, prince, ruler, and a magistrate. And, of course, archon is part of the compounded word archangel. And so an archangel is different than an angel. Angel can be used sort of generic for all angels and for a specific rank of angel that we'll talk about in a minute or two. But I just wanted to sort of get that word out, because when I was making a reference to the assembly of gods on Mount Olympus, that's where hierarchy comes from. It's there. But because it's a terrific standard, you can use it to understand things in other cultures and from within the Bible. And so, even the encyclopedias that I grew up with would list this hierarchy with nine orders, just as the definition stands. And I actually changed the hierarchy a little bit from, the standard hierarchy of angels that comes down sort of biblically from a church father named Dionysius, and that seems to be what this definition in Greek is based on, and also the encyclopedias are using. So he was a early church father who was trying to put things in basic orders. And so basically what he did was he put them in three different levels. And in the first order, he put seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. And thrones is really hard to get at in terms of what he's using there for what that particular angel that we would understand it in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I'll come back to that as well. And then he put dominions and lordships as two different names for the same thing together as one group, virtues and powers as being the same, and powers and authorities being the same. And powers shows up twice, as it does in the New Testament, which really gets confusing. And a lot of the names that these orders are listed have more than two names. Some of them have three different names as they're translated into English. So if you're trying to figure out the hierarchy from English, it's virtually impossible. And then in the third grouping, he places principalities, archangels, and angels together. And he doesn't really assign very clearly as to what's their authority and what's their position and what do they do. And so that's what I sort of attack and break down. And so it takes a few chapters to go through it. And one of the things I kind of noticed right away was that he had archangels in the third grouping. I guess it made a nice symmetry of 3, 3, and 3. But archangels are in the presence of God.
Yeah.
And so they ought to be in the first grouping, which are the watcher grouping. But he doesn't list them there. And the other hierarchy doesn't. I'm going, well, that makes no sense to me whatsoever, because they come from the presence of God. And actually, as I get further on into it, I actually will put them as even a higher level than the watchers surrounding the throne, but there will be four that will be on the four sides that head as a single angel, all four of the pillars, so to speak. And so I put them into four different pillars, along with the four different sides and four different watchers at the top in the first hierarchy. So when we look at the first hierarchy, I place seraphim as being in charge of government and also being in charge of religion. And then I place another group of angels below them, and then supported by angels. And angels, in their specific sort of rank and understanding, they're described as messengers. They're described as ministers. They're described as ambassadors. They are described in different ways, because I think that the way that they're described biblically will tell you which pillar that they would be coming down. So if you can sort of see three levels of angels, and then at the top you have the seraphim who are going to oversee government, and then I'll talk about these powers in a few minutes, and then they would have angels working the ground game for them. So they would be sort of like ambassadors of the government. You would have religions that seraphim are also responsible for, and I put principalities underneath that seraphim order with angels as ministers. And then archangel, which is the army or the warrior aspect, are archangels. And then I put the mighties below that. And then just as you see on a chessboard, the pawns are the foot soldiers of the warrior angels. And then I put cherubim and ophanim together as one group, with thrones as their responsibility, or the throne rooms, just as you see with the visible ones on earth with the thrones. And you would have the same in the council of the gods, and all of the gods in the 70 nations would have a throne room. And the Mighty Seven would have a throne room. Satan would have a throne room, just as God has a throne room. And I put dominions underneath those thrones, and then another set of generic angels doing the groundwork for them as well. So let's go back now to the First Order.
Okay.
And I just want to group those because I put seraphim, archangels, cherubim, and ophanim. And you could also, if you wanted, to take ophanim and put them into another column that might be slightly different, but just seemingly cherubim and these ophanim are grouped together. So it seems to me that they would be more likely to be grouped together. So the analogy or the allegory that we get sort of biblically for the throne of God comes in the vision of Ezekiel in 1:3-10, and you have this chariot of God, and you have these cherubim that are pulling the chariot. And we also get Book of Psalms that says the cherubim pull the chariot. And within the wheel of the chariot, there is another four-faced angel. But it's different than the four faces that's on a cherubim, because one of them is the face of a cherubim. We don't know whether that means one face of four or one of the four faces of a cherubim, but it's distinct with one face, and it's filled with eyes in these wheels. Now, the wheels is the Hebrew word Gilgal, but the beings inside are Ophan. And you put the IMA plural, male plural on it, and that's the Ophanim, and that's the group that's recorded in the Book of Enoch. So you can see that that word Ophan was the word used for Ophanim that was used in the English translation for the Ophanim in the Book of Enoch, showing that goes back to a Hebrew manuscript at some point in time. And a lot of the words and the phrases there would have a lot of Hebrew relationships with the Hebrew language that we see it translated into English from. So that's the first thing that is changed, is from the standard three, I have four up there. So under the seraphim, you have the powers, and this is a word that, excuse me, this is a group that is described as principalities. Yeah, no, I'm still there. I'm just drawing heavily on my memory here. So, so this is they're called rulers, and they're also called principalities. If I've got my memory right here, oh, I've got it wrong. I got it mixed up. So the powers here are, I've got it right. So it's the rulers, and you'll see it translated as principalities as well, and that's the Greek word arche. So you're going to see it translated into English in two different ways, so it's hard to know that they're the same being, but understand that the rulers and the principalities, when it's talking about the angels, come from arche, and then you have the angels below that. And so these are the ones that are bringing about government sort of edicts. They're like the middleman of the reach of the throne, and in this case, the government aspect of it, whether or not it's the king, the rulers, or the underlings underneath that, and they're implementing that within the earth from the throne room, and then the angels underneath them would be sort of the ground group that would do it. And in the religious column of the seraphim, then you have I'm sorry, I really messed that up. So what I just talked about in terms of of the rulers and the principalities and arche, that goes under the religious aspect of the seraphim. It's the authorities and powers, as they're described, that goes back to exousia as the ones that are underneath the seraphim. So exousia under seraphim and arche under the religious aspect. And again, you would have angels underneath both of those columns. And so if I make everybody perfectly clear, I messed that up the first time. Powers and authorities, exousia, and then rulers and principalities, arche. Arche is for the religious aspect, and authority and power, exousia, is for the government. The archangels have the warrior angels under them, and there's two groups that they might even be the same, but there might be even a hierarchy within it. But you have the mighties, as they're called in passages in the New Testament, and then another one that's called the Icarus. So the one that is mighty goes back to the Greek word dunamis. But in the book of Revelation, there's an especially powerful select few of these mighties, and they're called Icarus for some reason I've not been able to decipher. I kind of put them in with the same sort of group, but it might be another order. But these are the fighting ones. So when you see in Revelation 12 where the angels are warring, you probably are seeing most of this column led by archangels on both sides that are leading the armies. And then, of course, the angels that are the foot soldiers. Now, the cherubim and the ophanim, those are the thrones that Dionysius talks about. And underneath that are the dominions. And you'll see that translated from Koratashi. And then you have angels underneath that. So I put that right at the end of the chapters that would have the hierarchy of angels. In the hierarchy begins in chapter 12. I do the first hierarchy, and then I add in chapter 13, I add in the archangels and show you how I get there and why I think they belong in that first realm. And then in chapter 14, I'll get into the second and third hierarchies. And then on the last page of that, you'll see if you want to call it a chart, I have it in columns, and I put the seraphim on the left and the archangels, and then I give the responsibility in the next column over, and then I give the middle angels, and then I have all of the other angels, generic angel groups, for the ground working of those columns. So yes, I do put it in there, and it takes a few chapters to get through it and to explain it, because you know, when you have translators that are translating these words two or three different ways into English, it's impossible unless you take it back to the original Greek in the New Testament and then see how they fit with any mentions of those in the Old Testament.
Yes, I can imagine how difficult that is. So how do the giants fit into all of this then?
It's another really, really good question. And so there's an assembly of, in the Ugaritic text, there's the Baalim assembly at Mount Saphon. And then it also has an assembly of the Ditanu, spelled D-I-T-A-N-U, or sometimes just Ditan. And this is the same word that's used for the Tuatha De Danann in other languages, or the Tuatha Danu, the Tadua. It has, and I list them throughout the book and several times, all the different pronunciations of it. Hebrew, it would be associated with Dedan, D-E-D-A-N, for people who are familiar with the Bible. And so this is the tribe of the Raphaim in the Ugaritic text, the Raphiu, the Raphium, as we talked about it. This is the same assembly of the ring lords in Sumerian tradition at Nippur. This is where all the authority is invested into the giants as the spurious royal offspring of the gods, where they receive their divine right to rule physically, visibly in the physical world, and reporting up to specific patriarchal angels within the angelic hierarchy. And all throughout these 70 nations, with their thrones that they establish on each of the new branch nations, because there's more than 70 nations around the world, but you will see a heraldry that's encoded into the coat of arms that will have taciturn imagery that is showing a grafting in, a new dynasty, and bloodlines back to specific angelic beings from the council of the gods. So you're going to see imagery of unicorns. You're going to see imagery of eagles. You're going to see imagery of dragons. And imagery like that, that is representative of the angels in both the loyal council and of the disloyal council of the gods. And they establish their thrones and their realms around the world. And there's a specific hierarchy throughout that. But it all funnels back into the original 70 nations and original 70 counterfeit patriarchs, as I would look at it, from the royals coming out of these various tribes of the councils of the Baalim at Mount Hermon, that the Ugaritic text would call the assembly of the Tetanu.
So this is what Lucifer or Satan, because I know in some of the material you spoke about how Lucifer was above the watchers because he was able to walk through the fire by God's throne. So where does Lucifer fit in with all of this?
Yeah, another terrific question. So I spend a couple of chapters on Satan and explain who Satan is and some of the names that he has and the position that he has. So from a sort of 40,000 feet look, he is, as we understand him today, the one who sits above the council of the gods in Psalms 82, ruling over the 70 nations. And he and his counterpart would have originally have done that. So just as Osiris has Isis as a partner, just as Kronos had Gaia as a partner, and I did one different pantheons, one Egypt for after the flood and one Greek from before the flood. It's a standard doctrine that there is a partner god. And there's a creature that is killed in the Old Testament by God called the Leviathan, which is a multi-headed serpentine creature. And in the book of Isaiah, the other Leviathan, which I think is an allegory for not only Satan, but also for the multi-headed beast empire that rises in the end time out of the sea, a Leviathan type creature with multiple heads, is going to be dealt with in the end time. And it says killed in the end time or slain, but typically, as we understand, the gods being slain, they go to the pit prison for their crimes. But Satan, he has a plea deal, and he gets a delay in going there, but he goes at the end of the last 7 years, and then at the end of the millennium is let out again to start another rebellion, and then he goes to the lake of fire. So there's a little bit different process in how the Satan aspect plays out versus the other fallen angels. But I just wanted to pop in there because we're going to see more of this duality nature of polytheism come back in. And that somehow, some way, there's going to be a direct worship at some point in time after Antichrist comes to power of the divine feminine. And maybe even before, but more in the lower form. So you could see a worship of the pantheon of gods of the post-Diluvians that all had male and female gods and goddesses, and understood in the secret societies and the Gnosticism, somebody like Osiris would be a reflection or an allegory or a symbol for the chief god, even though it's the chief god of the time, Satan sits above it, and so it would be an allegory for whom they would call the great architect of the universe, or Lucifer, just as Lucifer is talked about as being the one who falls from heaven in Isaiah 14. And so look for that sort of duality to come back, because I think it's an important part of polytheist religions, and I think it's going to be a mystical religion in the end time. So I think we're going to see that duality come into play. And I could go down a couple other rabbit holes there, but I'll try and stay on course here. So in Satan, he is the one that's left out, and he is the one that sits above the council of the gods, as God sits at the top of the council of the gods in heaven. Now, there's two different words in Hebrew for the councils. It's moed, old Hebrew moged. It has gone through an evolution of an IN, which silences that G. So we understand it as Moed, as an assembly, where God is located, and the word used in Isaiah 14. But in Psalms 82, it's the word something a little bit different. Still an assembly, but not God's assembly. So important to make that sort of distinction, that when the Bible is talking about these two different councils, there's two different words. And so that word for Lucifer in Isaiah 14 is Hallel, H-E-Y-L-E-L. So as in with a name like Gabriel, which is an archangel, his name ends in E-L. As with Michael, if Michael, it ends in an E-L. Raphael, Uriel. The standard Hebrew wording for a name would be like Hallel. And this has a few different roots to the name, but it's going to mean something in terms of a god or an angel. And so you have this association with brightness, as it goes back to its original Hebrew word, and then another word where hubris and boasting is involved. But it's that shining aspect which is more what's being reflected here, even though the name has, and I cover both etymological roots back into Hebrew for Hallel on that. When people buy the book, they'll get a larger, fuller explanation on that. But that's reflecting of him as being part of the morning star order that we talked about in Job. And it's interesting because we don't normally think of him as part of the morning star, but when you look at that, Lucifer, son of the morning, and in Hebrew it's Hallel ben Shakar, then maybe it ought to have been translated from the Hebrew for the name and not as its meaning. So morning stars, Venus, as Lucifer is related to, which is perhaps one of the reasons why Lucifer was selected there, for translation, an Italian word for fit into the English language for a Hebrew word, rather odd, but so be it. You have this understanding of Satan, who is associated with the morning stars, and the morning stars, as in Venus, is a morning star, or more or less as a morning star, but Venus is also an evening star, and most people don't know that. And actually, in the Greek version of the history, they actually split it into two different gods. So, but again, kind of like in the Osiris manner, it's a reflection or an allegory for the parent god. But so Hallel ben Shakar, Hallel son of the morning, is one of those morning stars as part of his uniqueness. And he has many different aspects to him, as to who this individual being is, because he's the greatest of all the angels. He is different. So when we see him talked about in the New Testament, in Revelation 12, he's called a dragon, a devil, and a serpent. And the devil is kind of the Satan, that sort of reflection of the allegory. But dragon and serpent is reflective of a seraphim angel. And a seraphim works, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, works before the altar in the throne of God, in the fiery stones, just as one of the seraphim reached in with a fiery stone to take the sins away from Isaiah when he put it to his lips in preparation for the vision that he was about to receive. And so this is indicating that Satan had a seraphic form. And in the occult, the Hebrews said Samael was his name as a serpent or as a seraphim. And so he was the high priest before God, which shows you how far he fell. And which starts to answer the question as to why Jesus is going to be the new high priest as an immortal that will take over from the temporary priesthood that was put in with the Levites, who had 12 jewels. Satan had 7, another indication with those jewels as being one of the priests. And so Jesus will, after the end time, will succeed and fill that position that's void today, temporarily filled through the priesthood of the Levites, but not sufficient for sort of eternity. And one of the fulfillments of, you know, the mission of bringing about the Messiah, that's one of the aspects that's going to be completed. So we have to understand Satan as a serpent. And he wasn't a serpent when he went into to Eden, as a lot of people say he is, because they say the Nahash deceived Eve, but that wasn't really this other kind of being, which is a serpent being, a walking, talking, larger than human, intelligent, sorcerer type of being. It was Satan who did that in his seraphic form, except that that doesn't really fit in Ezekiel 28, where Satan is described as the anointed cherubim who was in Eden. The anointed cherubim that also walked amongst the fiery stones. Cherubim don't walk amongst the fiery stones. So he is in part cherubim. Another part of his distinctness. And he has a name that doesn't show up as Samael or Hallel in the book of Enoch as the angel that was in Eden that deceived Eve. The name shows up as Gadrael. So you kind of think, well, why is that? Well, it means in Hebrew, Gadrael, you can actually take that back to Hebrew words. It means wall of God or God's wall. But Satan had many names for each of his distinctions and his titles. So he has multiple names, and it was not uncommon for gods to have multiple names and multiple titles, whether it's loyal angels or fallen angels. And just as the kings had many names, so you have to be careful when you're going through prehistory and history, even with the chronologies, because you could be duplicating the dynasties because they could have up to 7 names. And when we look at that, then maybe Satan had up to 7 different names as well. And so we don't know all of their names, but what we do know is he is a morning star. He is a cherubim and he's a seraphim. But as we get his descriptions in the New Testament, he is described in some of those words as an archangel. So he also has a reflection of an archangel. So he's an archangel as well. And I cover off all of those connections in the book. The one I couldn't really make a connection to, and I didn't really talk about it, is I think there would be a reflection of the Ophanim in him as well. I couldn't find a direct connection on there, so I couldn't write about that. But because I think he possibly had like 7 different positions and names, I think Ophanae might be one of those. I just was not in my research having anything strong enough to make that assertion, other than he sits on his own throne in this world for a time longer, and is the god and the prince of this world.
Okay. So I have a question, and it has been sort of eating at me for a little while now. I don't mean tonight, but I mean in general. When God sent the Israelites into Canaan, he said he was going to send his lieutenant or something like his. He was going to send one of his bigwig angels ahead to clear the way. And I remember hearing that that was the energy, the spirit of Jesus that did that. And then there's the element of Melchizedek, who was not born and did not die. And that same spirit energy may have been the spirit energy of Jesus being here as Melchizedek. So when does the Holy Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost come into play? If Jesus is, you know, if Jesus is Melchizedek, if he's the lieutenant who leads the angelic tribe to you know, clear the way for the Israelites, I mean, if it makes sense that his energy as a spirit is present in heaven, but then we suddenly have the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, which, you know, is something most Christians hang on to, but in the beginning it wasn't there. Or was
it? No, it was essentially always there. I mean, they are a part of the tripart nature, and they are present almost from the time of creation. And I don't know how many different creations there might have been. We only get what we have sort of biblically. But how I look at it is Ruach is the Hebrew word for the spirit. So when you see the spirit hovering over the earth in the days of creation, that's a Ruach. And in the superlative sense. And in the creation in days 1 through 6, you have the word God that's being used, and that's the Hebrew word Elohim in the superlative and plural sense, with El being the singular force. So when in that application, you're actually seeing all three there. You just need to sort of understand it. So when God the Most High is being talked about, that's in a singular sort of sense. And that would be El Elyon in that application, God Most High, just as he's the one who sits over the council of the gods, or walks amongst the council of the gods in Psalms 82. And so it could also be a singular uppercase superlative sense for El. That's translated as the singular God. Now, when all three are kind of acting together, you could have Elohim, or you could have Elohim describing God in singular as well. You have to really understand the context, and the only way you can really do that is take it back to the Hebrew. So you get kind of some confusing sort of translations. But in Genesis 1, where it said, God said, that is Elohim Amar. Amar meaning speak. And so that's the word. That's the word of God, as we would know that in the New Testament, as word logos of God, theos. So logos, theos. And we know him as the word of God in June 1. So when we see now in Genesis 2, even though we see that the world was created by the word, as it is described in Colossians 1 and in John 1. And when God speaks, that's the word. That's how that process works. So we see all three there, with the speaking part as the word. We see Ruach in Genesis 1, 2, and we see the Elohim as God speaking or issuing the command, but all three are there and in its participation. It's all there for people to see. Now you see something different that happens in verse 2-4 and just before the creation of Adam that I think is a separate creation because the details are completely different than and out of order to what is in Genesis 1. And we don't know, we don't actually have a day 8. We have no idea how long it is after day 7 when this creation happens with Adam and then later Eve, which again is completely different than in Genesis 1. So you don't get Lord or God there. You don't get God there. What you get is, starting in 2-4, is Lord God. Now, that's two different words there with two different Hebrew words. One is Lord as in Yahweh or Jehovah, as the Strong's lexicon and in the more modern form of Hebrew reflects the tetragram, knowing that the W changed to a V in the evolution of the Hebrew language. And God is Elohim. And that is the same term or the cognate term of the Word of God, where you have Logos Theos, the Word of God, the Logos of the Theos. This is now the Yahweh or the Jehovah of the Elohim. And now Jehovah is going to have this interaction and creates the Adamites for their special commission. After the flood, you're going to have the same type of intimate relationship with Noah and the Noahites and with Abraham. It's going to be the Lord and the Lord God, Jehovah or Jehovah of the Elohim, that's going to be interacting throughout with the creation of the Israelite nation. So now, as we understand that sort of concept, the angel of the Lord, Melech of Jehovah, is the angel that is leading the Israelites in the time of the Exodus wars. And this is the same one that appears before Joshua before he takes over attacks Jericho after they've crossed the Jordan River. So you can get the angel of God as well, the angel of the Melech of El or the Melech of Elohim, depending on how it's which verse that you're looking at. But you wouldn't see that Melech El or the Melech of El. You only see that in the Old Testament as Elohim. So now it's the angel of God, or the spirit, as angel is also understood, a spirit being, as we talked about with Psalms 104 as the leading passage for this chapter. This is who is now appearing. It's the spirit. It is the word of God that is appearing before Joshua and leading Israel in the time of the Exodus. So now we have, if we understood that, you'll find that it's going to run consistent. Now if you're looking at Melchizedek, you're looking at an individual that is the king of Salem, and he's the king of righteousness, which is a title for the Messiah, right? He has that same title. But he wouldn't be a Jebusite or an Amorite that would have lived in Jerusalem at that time. So it's not going to be one of them. And obviously, the Israelite nation hasn't been created there. A lot of people have a lot of theories as to who it is, and some of the more novel ones or more interesting ones would be Shem, but doesn't seem to be Shem because there's no connection biblically back to Shem that is going to bless Abraham. So you have this individual that's called the King of Righteousness that's going to bless Abraham, who's going to create the Israelite nation so that you can bring about the Messiah that Jesus is going to eventually be made flesh in, through the bloodline of David, through Judah, through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah down to King David. And so the book of Hebrews says that this is a fellow who has no genealogy, no beginning and no end. That's Alpha Omega, just as Jesus is called Alpha Omega in the book of Revelation. God is as well at the beginning, and then Jesus ends as you get into Revelation 20 and 21. So this is describing somebody who's going to take over the Melchizedek order as an immortal who has no beginning and no end and no genealogy that's listed. This is Jesus. This is the Word of God as Spirit before he physically has the Holy Spirit create his oikotarian within Mary to dwell in so that he can interact physically in the world to go through all the trials of a corrupted world without sin and to be crucified and killed and charged for crimes he didn't commit and would be crucified for that. And again, it makes perfect sense because God wouldn't have the Word through, you know, arrive in the earth through some sort of sexual nature as with fallen angels, as they create giants, and then this mythos of that Antichrist who's going to have a similar sort of form. They're antithetical to each other. They're polar opposites. So this is a special creation that's designed for Jehovah to become the Word of flesh, Jehovah of the Elohim. Now, as we look at what he does there, he creates this physical body that obviously is just created for a short period of time to become Melchizedek to actually bless Abraham, who's going to start the seed line so that he can come in into the world in a physical form through Mary. And so now you have another passage that's in Genesis 18, which is after his form as being Melchizedek. And in Genesis 18, which is the chapter before the Sodom and Gomorrah destruction, he has come down to see for himself the sins of Sodom, and he takes the form of a man. And again, this is the Lord that Abraham is describing, Jehovah of the Elohim. And there's two other angels who take a physical form. And Abraham doesn't recognize them as angels at that time, but once he starts to speak with them, he understands. And they are taking this physical form, and they're eating, they're drinking, they're touching, and doing everything that the people would do sort of physically. So if we can learn to look at the New Testament supports the Old Testament, and is the basis for the New Testament is the Old Testament, there will be words that are used and terminologies that are used that work in perfect harmony if we take some time to try and understand how those things fit together. And in this case, Jehovah of the Elohim is the word logos of the God Theos of the New Testament. And you have the three-part nature. And Jesus, the Word is like a branch of God, as he's called a branch. And the Spirit is the Spirit of God that provides the life for all of the spirits. And they work in perfect harmony and are the perfect reflection of each other. And when you put all the passages together, there's no contradiction. They all sort of blend in to support each other. Now, there's one other interesting passage in the book of Zechariah where you have this throne scene and you have the angel of the Lord there, you have God there, and you have Ruach there, and you have Satan there, and then you have this pre-existent Jesus, just as Melchizedek would be a pre-existent Jesus, just as this form that the Word took in the Sodom story would be the pre-existent Jesus. You have a Joshua there that Jesus is rooted in terms of its meaning or of its original Hebrew form for Yeshua, as some people would also pronounce it. And I show that relationship in the book. So just understand that all that information, you'll find that in book two as you start to read through this. But you have Satan that's accusing the pre-existent Jesus, Joshua, before God and the angel of the Lord and the Spirit. And so this is a scene that sort of depicts that grouping and the distinctions. And of course, Joshua is going to be the one who, and that passage leads into an end time passage as you read on into Zacharias of that chapter. So again, it sounds a bit complicated, but when you boil it down to that sort of simple sort of understanding, it makes sense. And if we understand, when we're looking at Lord in the Old Testament, for the most part, it's going to be talking about Jehovah as you take that back to Hebrew, but 428 times, including Adon and Adonai, meaning Lord and my Lord, it could be talking about God or it could be talking about another individual depending on that application. But unfortunately, you've got this conflation of Lord from Jehovah over 6,000 times that's translated as Lord. And then you have this other term that are making it a bit confusing for people to read. And most people don't take the time, because why would you have to, you would think, to take it back to the Hebrew to get the full distinctions and how those words are being used.
Yeah. It's overwhelming, and actually to read your book all the way through is inappropriate. To read and study a section at a time is really far more appropriate for people, because it makes greater sense once you step back and listen to you talking about it, for sure. I was fascinated with the importance of Mount Hermon.
Yeah, it's probably the most recognized mountain in the world. It has many different names around the world. I know the occult also has seven sacred mountains around the world, but there seems to be one central mountain that everybody's talking about, and then you have similar ones that are around the world. And I think that's reflecting, you know, the seven wandering stars, as they're known in the Bible, that, you know, you have in the book of Enoch, the kings, the seven sort of Satans, as they're understood as lieutenants of Satan, and Satan's plural is used in the book of Enoch as well, and that these are the chiefs of the tens, and so seven times ten, you get to 70 nations, and then Satan's above that. So again, you see that sort of symmetry as you piece the information together. And so Mount Hermon would have had its name changed, and has, I think, taken on the name of what happened there. And so Mount Hermon is rooted in a word called Haram, C-H-A-R-A-M. You can have Hebrew spellings with an E as well. There's a few different ones, but they're all meaning basically, and understand again that, and it's really important that you apply the right meanings of these Hebrew or Greek words, because they can have multiple meanings. And so many, in a lot of cases, I just couldn't list them all, because they're all sort of nuances of some of the center main focal points of the meaning. So you have to really make sure you pick the right translation for that sentence and for the verse that it's in and the chapter that it's in, and that there aren't any contradictions. So there's a discipline when you're going back to Hebrew to look at the meanings, that make sure you don't select one that's just for your biases. You can't create conflicts in your preferred preconceived conclusion. So really tough to do, but very important to do. So and so Hermon is Hermanim, or Herman, and in the plural, with the I-M male plural, would be Hermanim. So that would be C-H-E-R-M-Y-N. And H-R-M would be the original Semitic spelling that's used for part of the meaning in the Ugaritic texts. And I show where that roots back to the Ugaritic text and that Semitic aspect, and then define Mount Hermon as meaning, it can mean devoted and consecrated and a place of sanctuary, but it can also mean a curse and accursed and words like that. And so, and it can also be used in conjunction to utterly destroy, as what's used in the time of the Exodus with the destruction of the giants in this ritual of a curse to destroy evil. And so where that goes back to, I think, is that the names changed from Sion or Shinir or Sirion or Saphon or Nippur and other names that, you know, you could look for around the world that would, if they were adequately describing where the cedar forest was, would be another transliteration of that same mountain. So what's important to understand is on Mount Hermon before the flood, not necessarily where the giants were created, but where the oath was sworn, which is the introduction to the oath-based system for the world. Well, that's part of the mystical religions and part of the legal system. This is the oath that was taken by, according to the book of Enoch, of the 200, the original 200 watchers. And watchers shows up in Daniel 4 times, i.e., for the meaning of watcher, same as a city, which was these high-walled cities of watch that the giants created, as the same spelling but a different Hebrew word, but Ayir means watcher, just as Draconta does for a dragon in Greece, in the Greek language, and similar types of understandings in the Egyptian. They have the Neteru gods, which were the watcher gods, and you also have the Anunnaki gods, which were watcher gods as well, and I explain all of that in book two as well, in various parts of the book. So Mount Hermon is this place where this oath was sworn to carry it out to the end, no matter what the consequences. And that was called Haram Anathema. And anathema is a Hebrew word that's used there for an absolute ultimate type of punishment or ostracization. So they're going to carry it out to the end no matter what. And this was where the original council of the gods was located, and with the parent gods, and then after the flood, where they probably reswore the oath with the Baalim, whose also assembly was there to create the Raphaim, as the Ugaritic texts show up and show up in the Bible as the Raphaim giants. And noting that Raphaim only shows up twice as it's translated in the KJV in Genesis 14 and 15 for the giant nations. But wherever else you see giant, except for Numbers 13, 33 twice, and once in Genesis 6, 4, where it's Nephil, and once in Joshua 16, where it's Gibor or Gibberim, all the other times where you see giant, it is Rapha and Raphaim. So this is that oath, this accursed oath was sworn on Mount Hermon, and I think it assumed that name within that legendary mythos, whether it's in Arabic, whether or not it is in Aramaic, whether or not it is in Hebrew. It is just the cultural name that Mount Hermon became known as, the mountain of the oath and the accursed oath to create the giants, to try and ensure both before and after the flood that humankind destroyed themselves from the face of the earth.
Wow. Well, so tell me, I mean, the one thing that of course fascinated me was, of course, you have unicorns here, and how they connect to the giants and Mount Hermon and the angels. And I know from history, I mean real history, not fantasy history, that that the original unicorns were not very attractive, according to the Bible or according to some of the old texts, but that they served a purpose. So can you kind of enlighten us as to the unicorns?
Yeah, two different aspects on it as my research continued, because I, when I see things and I'm going, well, that doesn't really make sense with this, I tend to dig a little bit deeper. So, you know, we know a unicorn today is these cute, cuddly little one-horned horses that were so playful that they didn't hear the calling to go to the ark, and so they didn't survive into the post-diluvian world. But in reality, they were something different. They were the horses that the kings rode into battle both before and after the flood. And they were like a chimera type of creature. So they had to be big enough for the giants. So they were bigger before the flood because the Rephaim were smaller than the Nephilim, but similar. And so they had different types of animal parts to them, and I give a full description of that in the book. But understand, they were kind of horse-like, but they were chimera. They had multiple different types of DNA modifications, and a horn big enough. And this is from a post-diluvian account, so who knows how big the horn was and what they could do with that horn before the flood. Is that they could, for the descriptions after the flood, they could kill a elephant with that horn. And these are the horses that the warrior Nephilim and Rephaim rode in onto battle on. And they were, even after the flood, there's unicorns that were, according to historians, bred in India that were similar. But then there's also these white horses that the Persian kings were using, which were even taller than these ones that were in India. And so whether it would be Darius, for example, he would lead, he would have two chariots that he'd have these horses that were leading. One that he would ride in, one was empty for the god of war that would be going into battle with them. So this is a common sort of understanding that's been lost, that these were, I think, biological DNA manipulated creatures that were designed for war and for the warrior Nephilim and Rephaim, and that because they were DNA manipulated, they weren't playfully not paying attention for when they should go to the ark. They weren't called, but only animals that were not DNA manipulated or corrupted were called to the ark, and God knew which ones had not had any DNA manipulation, and those and there probably wasn't that many because the whole earth was corrupt, and he called the ones that were free of corruption
pure.
To the ark, pure, to start the life again after the flood. Now that's word corrupted is where you get a little bit of extra information in here. That's the Hebrew word shakath, and it means to pervert, to ruin, to decay, to destroy, words like that. And so the whole earth became corrupted, and that means the DNA and the plant genome, and that was from that high level of technology that we've talked about on probably the last show and previous shows that had a level of technology given to the giants that we're just catching up to today that could destroy the whole earth, which is why the flood had to come about. So that's the horse that's associated with the giants. And even as it comes down through history, you've got, whether it's Napoleon riding a white horse or Julius Caesar riding a white horse, and he also had a black horse. Alexander had this great horse. They were trying to emulate that history, that mythos. And if you look at a picture, if people were to Google it, it's called The Riders of the Side or the Sea or the Shea. It's spelled S-I-D-H-E. If you Google that, you're going to see this picture of this Tuatha Dé Danann, the Tanu, the tribe of Danu, that are, you know, have these serpentine things. They have these fairy godmothers, these pale-skinned royales riding on horses that are large and white. And then they have this helmet on this horse that either is just decoration to represent this horn sticking out, or it's actually a cap on the horn so it doesn't hurt anybody. And they take their sharpness out of it by putting that cap on it. So that's the imagery of the animal. Now, if you take that imagery and line up with some other New Age and Eastern and Gnostic belief systems, is that they also believe that the unicorn is some sort of angelic being, which is really interesting because we don't get an angelic being that is described as a horse, but we don't get the descriptions of all of the angels that we listed in that hierarchy. So, you know, if people were to go to the a book called the Pistis Sophia, it's a Gnostic book. It has these parent gods that are in the pit prison for the crimes that they created, and they have all sorts of different looks to them, from serpentine looks to lion faces to dog faces to monkey and ape faces, bear faces, and who knows, they could be describing some of the looks of these orders that I was talking about, because we don't get those descriptions in the Bible, just of some of the watchers. We get some descriptions and that's it. So in those lower ranks, you could see those as being those descriptions. And if people just want to get a hold of me through my website, I'll just send you that one page or two page piece of it where it lists all of these fallen angels in that pit prison, their names and their descriptions that are in there. And so when we look at the Greek version of the gods, you have gods like Zeus and Apollo and other gods and goddesses. They had chariots pulled by white horses again. And these fly through the sky. And as you get older in that, these were unicorn horses. And these are the chariots of the gods. And what's really interesting about that is that this is, from a Christian perspective, a counterfeit of the image that's going on in Ezekiel 1, 3, and 10, where you have the cherubim pulling these chariots. These are the throne of the Greek gods of the assembly of gods, and they have their own chariots, only they're being pulled by these unicorns and their cherubim in the Bible. And the horn and the unicorn, particularly as it applies to this allegory, is like the third eye as part of it, but a receptacle of the knowledge of this angelic being that's passed through interdimensionally through this third eye. And that's this high level of knowledge that Dionysius talks about as he explains the hierarchy as having this extraordinary divine knowledge that's being passed on. So there's this knowledge that is also associated with cherubim, as well as being a warrior type of angel as well, because they have flaming swords protecting Eden, as they're described in the book of Genesis. So these are angelic beings. So when you see the heraldry on a coat of arms, if you see an eagle on a coat of arms, that should remind you of these eagle type of creatures called Anunnaki seen on reliefs, just as you see human heads also seen with the exact same depiction with these wings, same types of bodies, thick legs, only one's the head of an eagle, one's the head of a human, two faces of a cherubim. Because the cherubim would only take one face when they were in the physical realm. They also had a face of an ox or a bull, I think more bull than ox, and the face of a lion. And so these are the cherubs that guarded the palaces. These are the cherubs that protected the temples. These are the cherubs that protected the passageways in polytheist history and mythology into Hades or the other world or Nibiru. So these were beings of specific purpose dealing as warriors, but they also had this great knowledge. And so when we look at this unicorn, it's also an allegory for that single horn antichrist type figure that shows up in Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, Daniel 7 being the beast empire. And he grows up as a small horn amongst the ten horns, as a single horn, as a unicorn. And again, as that single horn, as the goat, and Alexander as being the first of that allegorical line in Daniel 8, again, as the single unicorn. And so expect that one should see relationships between the unicorn in that aspect and to Antichrist, not only with the third eye, with extraordinary wisdom, but also as the single horn, as unicorn, is used in the KJV Bible. And in the KJV Bible, unicorn is translated from a Hebrew word called rem. It means a wild bull. It has nothing to do with a horse. But a unicorn is used in association with, is it's mistranslated that way, as unicorn. And who knows, might have been a single horn bull, but typically we understand bull with two horns in the allegories. So it's kind of strange you would substitute that, but it's used in association with Mount Hermon and with association with Ephraim as being this bull that's going to gore the nations with his single horn, or as Antichrist will gore the nations with his horn, as that allegory will be applied to him. And that King, the mighty King James, the Gabor Royal James, who declared the divine right to rule, who wrote three demonology books or a three-part series of it, could all be one product, but as a three-part nature, and as a royale initiated into the occult from childhood, you have the King James Version Bible that is going to have that unicorn imagery put in. And he has a unicorn in his coat of arms that represents a cherubim, as well as a lion, which is another face of a cherubim. And the Hanover dynasty, that is the Windsor dynasty that succeeded eventually after all of the wrestling back and forth of the Jacobite dynasties, they have two unicorns. And so this is a very important... So it's a very important imagery. And so lion would go back to a cherubim as well, right, in terms of the genealogical imagery that's being put in there. So they have a lot of angelic beings that are put into the heraldry that was used as a standard originally where they were traveling from country to country. They would put their banner up there and would have the imagery of their heraldry, and they would know instantly their position in the bloodlines, where they're from, and their genealogies.
Wow. Somebody sent in a question that's kind of interesting. If God had watchers surrounding his throne, does that mean that Satan also had watchers of his own surrounding his throne? And if so, they appeared to have a reptilian look to them. Could they have any connection to the reptilians that people are talking about as far as alien people that are here on the planet?
Yeah, so a few things that are wrapped up in that question. Great questions for sure. So I always like to talk about I'm Christian and I talk from a Christian biases and I look for commonalities and patterns, but the polytheist version tends to, from my viewpoint, from a monotheist lens, counterfeits the monotheist or everything about God. Now, from the flip side of that coin, polytheists say the same about monotheists, so that's why it's important to learn as much as you can and make your own decisions so you know why you believe what you believe. So with that being true, from whichever side of the coin you're coming from, then yes, Satan's throne room would look identical to God's throne room, with the same types of watchers and represented in the same way, because he tried to raise his throne up to be heaven to be like God. Everything's going to be the same, just with rebellious ones. So there's rebellious angels in every rank and order that's part of the rebellious hierarchy. And I think you see some of that representations in that Pistis Sophia mention that I made with the different faces of these gods in the physical world. Now, seraphim have a serpent face, so they would in their self have produced serpent-like beings. And we talked about in the show last week that that look was diluted because they had a requirement to intermarry amongst humans because they didn't produce enough females, as my research shows, and that they, as they continued to introduce human bloodlines and dilutions, and to ensure that blood diseases didn't occur, they began to lose that serpentine look. So the original watchers that were created were likely all seraphim, and they populated most of the gods and the pantheons in that serpentine look, and most of the kings were depicted as serpents. And you also had this Nahash figure that we talked about, which means serpent, and, you know, is the crawling, slimy snake that we know it as today, but it was created before humans were in day six as a beast of the field, as it's described in Genesis 3:1, and that it was obviously following the fallen angels and willing partner with Satan, coached or avatar effect to deceive Eve. And if fallen angels were able to save some of the giants, then you would have maybe some of the Nahash, the serpent, that were saved in the world somehow, some way. So in the earth, in another dimension in the earth, as in the other world, off the earth, wherever, somehow, some way, maybe that they survived. And so we have two types of serpentine beings that sort of show up in the alien sort of mythos that are possibilities. Now, at the low end of the occult hierarchy, you have the elementals, and we also have elementals, as they're known as rudiments, and or the Greek word stoichon in the original Greek. That word can be translated as a elemental particle or element of the physical world, or as beings, as in the book of Galatians and elsewhere describes, as making us subservient to them as part of the visible ones in the hierarchy, along with the royales. They're at the bottom, though, and I've talked a lot on shows about the little ones as three groups of the elementals: good-looking ones, mischievous ones, and ugly ones. Ugly ones like gnomes that would have a direct affiliation with the greys, described similarly, identically. Flying machines come through portals and kidnap people, do sexual experimentations on them, looking to improve their DNA. I put two descriptions in book one on fairy abductions. They're called gnomes, fairy gnomes, gray gnomes. And if you didn't know it was a fairy abduction, you'd swear it was a gray alien abduction, because it probably is. But these are, you know, over 100 years ago, and one I think was about 400 years ago is the two examples I did. So predate the modern, after Roswell, modern alien mythos that we have going today. So they could be part of that hierarchy, but it's the fourth group that is a larger being than the little ones. They're called salamanders, and they're reptilians, and they're a little bit larger than humans, and they seem to be also akin to the creatures that people say they're seeing in the earth. So we have a few different groups where we could have these reptilian type of beings showing up from, or there could be three different groups of reptilians in that hierarchy. So there's a connection there. And we also have in the elemental tradition and the fairy tradition, one and the same, that some of them have the ability to change their looks, changeling quality, as what their spurious fathers were. Again, from the celestial mafia godfathers, as I like to call them, or the fallen angels or the gods of polytheism, who created these little ones. And in those accounts, all through sexual encounters, just like they did the Nephilim. So they're like a kind of Nephilim type of being, but just lower in that sort of hierarchy. And that the reptilians that are the salamanders are higher than the elementals, but below the giants and or their disembodied spirits. So again, reflecting a hierarchy.
So all the humans on the planet at this point in time can be traced back to this time when the angels rebelled and came into the women of Earth, so that all of us have within our DNA part of that Nephilim and part of the Nephilim.
Yeah, I think you can make a case for that. We don't know how widespread it is. There'd be, manifestations and pure levels. But I think, when you look at how the different blood types are created, you have this peculiar Rh negative one that's missing the D antigen that somehow joins the human positive blood type, and that the Rh negative in the royal tradition of the polytheist tradition say that the Rh negative has passed through the matriarchy again. And another reason why the matriarchy bloodline was used to start new dynasties, because they were rare, but it passed on the Rh negative blood. Now about 15% of the population has Rh negative blood, very heavily weighted throughout the royals. Like O negative would be the Windsor bloodline. Plantagenet and presidents going back to the Plantagenet genealogy, which is junior offshoot of the Anjou, also tend to have Rh negative blood. The heaviest concentration of the Rh negative is generally within sort of English and Northern Europe for the heaviest concentration of the Rh negative blood. And the heaviest one, just as an oddity, is in the Basque community, and in their mythos or their history, depending on how you want to look at that, is that they look at themselves as Homo Atlantis, and they were survivors of the flood in that history, and they started the Egyptian civilization after the flood, the Mesopotamian, the Asia Minor, Scythian civilization, and centered their civilization, where most of them settled, in the southern France region and northern Spain. And their Rh negative blood type will range, depending on which survey you're looking at, ranges from 50% to 80%. And they consider themselves superior to the migrating giant royal bloodlines into Europe. And that got to be a rivalry, and thus the Basque diaspora. So the Western royal families pushed them out of Europe in a diaspora. And it was just another power play. They've done many of those power plays with other rival bloodlines around the world. So, yeah, you have this Rh negative population that seems to be connected to the genes, because it's the genes that will produce the blood type, which is how you get Rh negative. It's missing something added into the human positive blood type, and that it can skip a generation depending on what's going on with those genes and the intermarriages that are going on. So is it completely throughout the Earth? I think the more we go, the more likely it is, especially when you have so much migration around the Earth these days that you're seeing more and more and more of that being spread. You had parts of the world that had almost zero Rh negative bloodline, you know, up, you know, 50 to 75 years ago, or 1%. So, but that's changing as you're seeing more intermarriage. So, you know, I think as we get closer to, you know, the end time, that number probably gets up a lot. But I wouldn't be looking at that as the as sort of the DNA corruption aspect. I'd be more concerned with other DNA corruption that comes along with science, with chimera type of things like that. So, and even if you do have Rh negative blood, or even if you do have the gene of Isis, or the Zeus genes, or if you have the and they call that the Cretan genes, or the Julia genes, or the Elbe genes, or the Elven genes, and there's a genes for all of them. The genealogy comes from that genes, and the genealogical tree was designed to map out the Royale's bloodlines. That would everybody's familiar with the family tree. I cover all of this off in the book, in book two, is what's really important and what they're really tracking. But the Rh negative is one of those trackers as well, but it's the genes. So yeah, I think it's possible that it's way more than 15%. I just don't know how much. But one thing I do know is it has nothing to do with salvation. You know, even in the Old Testament laws that were given to Israel is that the sins of the father did not pass on beyond the third or fourth generation. So even if that was applied to people that could not receive salvation, that would stop after three or four generations. And so my personal belief is that angel, different spirit, counterfeit spirit of the giants, and human spirits, we all have free choice. Doesn't matter what our genes are. And if we choose God, then from a Christian perspective, you'll be saved. And that's all it takes. Anything that you inherit innocently, you're not held accountable for. It's when you willfully do things that enter into that theater, then all the rules change after that.
Yeah, it's just the reason I asked is because there's so much evil going on in the world today. I was wondering if people were just kind of being led by their genetics or their bloodline or the percentage they had of the Nephilim material in their blood, if it was what was natural to them and consciously they just flowed that way, or if it wasn't. I mean, I can, you know, you can look at some people and you know that there's just evil there and you don't know where it comes from. And then you look at other people and you know that there's purity there, there's innocence there.
Yeah.
So
it's
more than just the environment that creates these people. It has to be something inside of them as well.
I'm sure there might be different levels of that. But you know, we get some examples in the Bible where, I mean, it may be more difficult, granted, but you know, there's an example in the time of the Exodus. And again, this is covered off in book two, where you have, people called the Gibeonites who make a treaty with Joshua, and they say they're foreigners. And most people say these are just sort of some sort of Canaanite tribe, and they're not. They're from Gibeon, and it's one of the most powerful royal cities of the giants, filled with mighty ones. And they had a pentapolis of cities, and they were so... The other alliances were so upset at that time that they decided to go attack the Gibeonim, as I like to call them, or the Hivim, the branch of the Hivim, from, you know, taking a patriarchally named branch to Gibeonite, Gibeonim versus Hivim. The other pentapolis of the alliance, they go and attack the Gibeonites first, because they can't have that happening. And then they decide they would, you know, it's preferable to do that instead of attacking Joshua first, who's the one actually is invading the land. So we know these are giants, is the point. And what happens with this treaty is that it's done deceitfully, but Joshua, who has the authority of God to, and is entrenched with that treaty, has to honor that treaty, and they become temple servants. And if you're going to be temple servants, and there's a bloodline descendancy of these called the Nephonim that show up in the time of Solomon, and then again with the return from Babylon, as that bloodline continues as temple servants, you wouldn't be serving in the Holy of Holies as a servant or around it if you weren't a believer in the God. So it shows even at that time, they had the ability to choose. But the influences and maybe their DNA would make that more difficult for sure.
It's just, you know, everything that you've got here obviously is giving a foundation for a better understanding of the times that we're already in. And, you know, I can see influences here and there. And, you know, what I pick up is probably different from what other people do too. But that it's important to understand what's making up these armies that are going to fight an end time battle. And what weapons we have as humans are minuscule in comparison to what they've got to play with.
Yeah. Well, and when you look at those riders, or the riders and whatever they're riding on that is in the 200 million man war in Revelation 9, and you line that up, and I do this later on in book two, the descriptions of this war that is before the Armageddon war that's in Joel 3, but the descriptions in Joel 1 and 2 with this army is the exact same description as this 200 million man army. And these are chimera type of beings with some sort of chimera rider that's on top of them. These might be Oikitarian units for disembodied spirits that are riding. And you have these biological weapons similar to, but different in their descriptions than what the unicorns are, but used for the same purpose. It's absolutely crazy some of the things that we might see that's going to make up some of these wars that are coming about before the end of the age.
Is it a series of wars or just one major one?
A series of wars. And we're getting a bit prophetic here, which is later in the book, but just as you have birth pains or sorrows, they get stronger, but they're the same type of pain. So you have wars, rumors of wars, pestilence, earthquakes, and famine are the sorrows that get stronger throughout the fig tree generation and the generation of Noah as the part of the contextual understanding. And in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 17, and 21, on Jesus' oration. And by the time you get to the seal judgments, that's 25% destruction of the world and of the people. So you could have a war that's 5% destruction that would seem apocalyptic-like or Armageddon-like, and people would think that this is going to be the day of the Lord. So much so, in Revelation 6, it has the kings of the earth who are running into their caves for protection, because we all know they have underground bunkers for their own protection, and all the secret societies in every town that they live built all of these tunnels for protection once they took authority over each of those towns and charted out their town square. And that those wars get stronger. That's not even the Joel 1 and 2 Revelation 9 war, because that's in the trumpets. So somewhere about the beginning of the last 7 years, you have this horrible war, and then you have 33% destruction in the trumpet war of Joel 1 and 2, Revelation 9 and Ezekiel 38 and 39. And then over 4 years later, you're going to have the Armageddon war. So it gets stronger. The wars get stronger.
But what's the purpose of it?
To destroy humankind from the face of the earth.
But then it's got to just start again.
Well, what happens is before all flesh is destroyed, Jesus comes back, according to Christian prophecy. So it doesn't get to that point, but if you understand some of the imagery, it starts to make some sense. And I know we're getting close to the end of the show, so I'll be fairly quick on this. You have this interdimensional technology with CERN and stuff that's going on, and you have Shiva that's associated with that. Shiva is a destroyer god, so it would be a cognate god and the same god as Abad and Apollyon, meaning destroyer. And so this is the god that recreates through its destruction. So it destroys everything for the ability to recreate. So if you had a war that was that destroyed the whole war by whole earth by fire, as 2 Peter 3 talks about, that caused the water that was in the water to collapse, and the whole world perished, and it didn't in the flood. And that destruction was by fire, that's reserved for the end time for fire, as in nothing is new as under the sun. And that, I'll just add in this, as you get into that verse in Ecclesiastes 1, it says that, you know, learning this knowledge only brings grief and sorrow to understand that nothing is new under the sun, what was will be again. That this destruction that they want to bring about is so that they can make a world where humans aren't. And that they can win a realm of their own so that the pantheon can continue to reign, and that they can provide oikotarians dwelling places for the spirit, for their disembodied spirits of their spurious offspring. They don't really want this new world going forward for humans. They just want to destroy humans, even though, and it's all out of spite now, because after the resurrection, which the fallen ones didn't know, otherwise they wouldn't have had Jesus crucified, as 1 Corinthians talks about. Their fate was already sealed, but they continued to deceive their followers with this promise of this utopia, but it's going to be destruction first, and it's the imagery of the phoenix rising out of the ashes. So it's only for those with the gene of Isis that they're looking for that new age, not humans.
Goodness. Just quick, because we are real close to the end, want to give your website and where people can get a hold of you and ask questions if they've got them?
Yeah, so the best place to get a hold of me is through my website. That's the Genesis6Conspiracy.com. That's Genesis 6, the number 6Conspiracy.com. And on the website, there is a contact the author. And if you want to get some more information on some of the things that we talked about, I have a lot of documents, name it by topic. I have too many to send out all at once, and I don't have one monster file to do it. I have a lot of documents. Just ask me the question or ask for the documents that you want by name. I'll get back to you. It might take me a month or so to get back to you, but I will get back to you. If you want to know more about my books, there's a generous excerpt of book one, all 98 chapters, and book two, all 84 chapters. So you'll get a good feel with the table of contents and then with a generous excerpt. But it's just a small drop that's in the books. There's just so much information in both of the books. If you wanted to buy a signed copy, you can go to the Buy Now page, and you can get a signed copy from me. I have a page for Canada. I have a page for the U.S. And if you live anywhere else in the world, there's an international page. So go to that appropriate page. If you wanted to buy one of each, I don't have them linked for a discount, but I have multiple price points at discounts. If you wanted to buy 2 books and you wanted one of each, just buy 2 of 1, send me an email through the website using the contact the author, and tell me you want 1 book of each, and I'll ship you 1 book of each. And if you wanted to link over to Kindle, there's links to the digital version from the Buy Now page, and links for Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and Amazon.ca. So that's the best way to get a hold of me and my book. And when I get the links for the audio books, that it looks like I've got a deal done for each of those today. I just have to get it all done in writing. We'll get that done tomorrow. Hopefully book one will be out on audio in 2 months, and book two will be 2 months after that. And there'll be connections to my website as well, and that'll be done through Amazon Audio.
Okay. Thanks so much, and we will see you next week. And I want to thank everybody for being with us, and do follow us and keep up with this information. It's amazing, and it's exciting, and I promise you, you will not be disappointed. Good night now. See you next Monday.